Office of Strategic Influence. The Defense Department's recent actions have done little to inspire confidence that traditional American liberties will be respected if the Posse Comitatus Act is abolished. Following the 9/11 attacks, the Pentagon announced that it was creating the Office of Strategic Influence, or OSI, which was designed to present a more favorable image of the U.S. military to foreign news media. The new organization provoked an immediate controversy when it was learned it planned to influence international opinion by planting false stories in the foreign media. Considering the closeness of the world today, thanks to the Internet, such false stories could easily find their way back into the domestic media. This was nothing new. The CIA had used similar tactics for decades, but this was too blatant. Even the major media, including the New York Times, were stirred to action. Mingling the more surreptitious activities, such as Pentagon covert operations like computer network attacks, psychological activities, and deception, with the work of traditional public affairs would undermine the Pentagon's credibility with the media, the public, and governments around the world, noted the Times. In a rare step backward, in early 2002, the government announced the OSI would be closed, though Donald Rumsfeld, then Secretary of Defense, argued that criticism of the OSI was off the mark. He nevertheless admitted that the office has been so damaged that it's pretty clear to me that it cannot function. Rumsfeld refused to let the matter lie. At a November 18, 2002 press briefing, the Defense Secretary defiantly stated, "And then there was the Office of Strategic Influence. You may recall that. And, oh my goodness gracious, isn't that terrible? Henny penny, the sky is going to fall. I went down that next day and said, fine, if you want to savage this thing, fine, I'll give you the corpse. There's the name. You can have the name, but I'm going to keep doing every single thing that needs to be done, and I have." True to his word, only the name of the office was abolished, and OSI activities were merely shifted to another agency. Yet this time, Rumsfeld's vow to continue his program of disinformation was not repeated in the corporate mass media. With this type of propaganda and disinformation program continuing, small wonder many concerned Americans are suspicious about the accuracy of the corporate mass media news content. Oath Keepers. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter, so help me God. This is the U.S. Uniformed Services Oath of Office, administered to the military and law enforcement officers. Nowadays, those who try to stay true to this oath are viewed as zealous or jingoistic. Even the word patriot is now looked at as un-American. One group of government employees that have been adamant about staying true to their oaths is the Oath Keepers. According to the Oath Keepers website, Oath Keepers is a nonpartisan association of currently serving military, reserves, National Guard, veterans, peace officers, and firefighters who will fulfill the oath we swore with the support of like-minded citizens who take an oath to stand with us, to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, so help us God. Our oath is to the Constitution. Our motto is, not on our watch. Some domestic police officials and soldiers serving in Iraq and Afghanistan have begun wearing Oath Keeper patches on their uniforms. The Oath Keeper's patriotism was soon attacked by commentators such as Bob Hanifin, a staff writer for the military and foreign affairs journal Veterans Today and a retired Air Force officer. In a special report headlined, "Are Right-Wing Extremists Trying to Recruit Our Troops?" Hanifin wrote, "Taking oaths to disobey orders of any chain of command is not only illegal under the UCMJ, Uniform Code of Military Justice, but it is also illegal under the Hatch Act, which most of our troops, including junior officers, don't know the meaning of. He added, "We will leave it to the Department of Homeland Security, unless they have been too intimidated by the right wing, Department of Defense, and our readers to decide if what Oath Keepers is doing to attract our troops to take an oath to potentially disobey orders from their chain of command is legitimate, or if the Department of Defense and Homeland Security needs to closely monitor such recruitment." Hanafin's article caused reactions from a number of Oath Keepers, such as Patrick M. Fahey, who responded in his blog by writing, "The Hatch Act of 1939's main provision is to prohibit federal employees from engaging in partisan political activity. That is why, during basic training, military recruits are told you can't protest in uniform." Now, on to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The UCMJ is the governing body of law for the military. It lists out what you can be charged for, the regulations for pretrial confinement, non-judicial punishment, etc. Mr. Hanafin says that under the UCMJ it is unlawful to disobey an order, which would be correct in most circumstances. Fahey dissected 8 separate articles of the UCMJ and concluded that the Oath Keepers would not violate the requirements of these articles. Oath Keepers have pledged to disobey only orders that fall into the following categories. 1. We will not obey orders to disarm the American people. 2. We will not obey orders to conduct warrantless searches of the American people. 3. We will not obey orders to detain American citizens as unlawful enemy combatants or to subject them to military tribunal. 4. We will not obey orders to impose martial law or a state of emergency on a state. 5. We will not obey orders to invade and subjugate any state that asserts its sovereignty. 6. We will not obey any order to blockade American cities, thus turning them into giant concentration camps. 7. We will not obey any order to force American citizens into any form of detention camps under any pretext. 8. We will not obey orders to assist or support the use of any foreign troops on U.S. soil against the American people to keep the peace or to maintain control. 9. We will not obey any orders to confiscate the property of the American people, including food and other essential supplies. 10. We will not obey any orders which infringe on the right of the people to free speech, to peaceably assemble, and to petition their government for a redress of grievances. Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes noted that his group only wants to have military and law enforcement members think carefully about the orders they receive. For example, if a police officer feels he is being asked to do an illegal search of a home or vehicle, he should stand down, Rhodes said. Yet despite the fact that the Oath Keeper pledge was seemingly written with the general good in mind, the organization was attacked by the Alabama-based Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, which described Oath Keepers as a particularly worrisome example of the Patriot Revival. I'm not accusing Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes or any member of his group of being Timothy McVeigh or a future Timothy McVeigh, said SPLC spokesman Mark Potok. What's troubling about Oath Keepers is the idea that men and women armed and ordered to protect the public in this country are clearly being drawn into a world of false conspiracy theory. Hate crimes. It should be noted that the SPLC has come under its share of criticism, despite well-funded promotion and close ties to Democratic politics. Founded in 1971 by Morris Dees and Joseph J. Levin, Jr., the nonprofit center has fought to enact laws against hate crimes ranging from hate-inspired murder to outbursts of speech. The SPLC often invokes the name of Oklahoma City bomber McVeigh, thought to be connected to white supremacist groups, as an example of the results of hate crime. The SPLC regularly conducts highly profitable fundraising activities. According to Ken Silverstein of Harper's Magazine, one example occurred about 10 years ago when the center earned $44 million, $27 million from fundraising, and $17 million from stocks and other investments, but spent only $13 million on civil rights programs, making it one of the most profitable charities in the country. By 2005, the SPLC reported an endowment fund of more than $152 million. Armed with millions of dollars, the SPLC has displayed a hatred for haters. The center disparaged the Minuteman Project, a group devoted to preventing illegal border crossings into the United States from Mexico. On the SPLC website, it was reported, "Major elements of the Minuteman anti-immigration movement are broadening their agenda to become part of a resurgent anti-government patriot movement." Internet commentator Judy Andreas, who conducted an in-depth investigation of the SPLC, stated, "The Southern Poverty Law Center may, at one time, have been a force dedicated to preserving the American values of freedom and constitutional rights through American law, but they have strayed far afield from their initially stated goals. Today they are wildly flailing accusations at anyone who, in their estimation, is guilty of a hate crime. And as their brush continues to broaden, they are busily applying sweeping strokes to the word racism and hungrily scanning the landscape for anyone who dares to oppose the actions of any non-white individual, group, or nation. Whether the non-white individual has committed an act of criminal conduct appears to be irrelevant to the SPLC." Despite trying to obtain donations while pressing for more hate crime legislation, the SPLC's own website, quoting crime experts, admitted that the whole hate crime reporting system is plagued with errors. Regardless, the SPLC's lobbying efforts proved successful in late October 2009 when Congress passed 68-29 in the Senate, 237-180 in the House, the Matthew Shepard Hate Crimes Prevention Act, named after a gay Wyoming college student murdered in 1998. This bill broadened the formerly narrow range of actions, for example, discrimination in admittance to school or voting, that makes it acceptable for the federal government to intervene in cases where a state is unwilling or unable to prosecute an alleged hate crime. Joe Solomese, president of the Human Rights Campaign, one of the nation's largest gay rights group, was pleased with the bill, describing it as "our nation's first major piece of civil rights legislation for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Too many in our community have been devastated by hate violence." Yet there was still controversy with the bill. After Iowa Republican Representative Steve King failed in his effort to add an amendment specifying that pedophiles could not use the law as protection of their conduct, the bill was derisively nicknamed the Pedophile Protection Act. South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint believed the bill was a dangerous step toward thought crimes and serves as a warning to people not to speak out too loudly about their religious views. How could legislation that has prompted so much controversy and debate sail through Congress? The answer is simple. It was attached to the $680 billion Defense Appropriations Bill. Congress had the choice of voting for expanding the dubious hate crime laws or voting against funding the nation's military personnel. The inclusion of the controversial language of the hate crimes legislation, which is unrelated to our national defense, is deeply troubling, said Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, one of the Republicans who voted against the bill. DARPA. Evading confinement in a military-run FEMA camp or hoping for assistance from an oath keeper may be the least of a modern American's worries. The government is now intruding into the public's lives on a wide scale. In any police state, surveillance of the population is paramount. In late 2002, it was revealed that the Army's Intelligence and Security Command, INSCOM, in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, planned to use high-powered computers to secretly search the citizenry's email messages, credit card purchases, telephone records, and bank statements on the chance that one might be associated or sympathetic to terrorists. Meanwhile, the Pentagon's new Office of Information Awareness, OIA, was to create a vast centralized database filled with information on the minutest details of citizens' private lives. Opponents of this plan were incensed at the appointment of John Poindexter, a former National Security Advisor and Vice Admiral, as the head of the OIA. Poindexter had previously been involved in the Iran-Contra scandal during the Reagan administration, which involved the illegal sale of weapons to Iran and using the profits to fund the CIA-backed Contra army fighting in Nicaragua, all done in defiance of Congress. Poindexter lost his National Security Advisor job in 1990 after being convicted of lying to Congress, defrauding the government, and destroying evidence. But from 1996 to 2003, as Vice President of Syntec Technologies, Poindexter worked with the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, to develop Genoa, a powerful search engine and information harvesting program. In 2002 and 2003, he served as Director of the DARPA Information Awareness Office, IAO, tasked with creating all-encompassing electronic and computer surveillance, total information awareness, in the war on terrorism. But after a public outcry over the possibility that such a mass surveillance program could be turned on honest Americans, Congress stopped IAO funding and Poindexter lost his job. Researchers believe that some of the IAO programs continue to operate today under different names and other funding. Christopher H. Pyle, a teacher of constitutional law and civil liberties at Mount Holyoke College, wrote that law enforcement agencies would search for terrorists makes sense. Terrorists are criminals. But why the Army? Is it a criminal offense for Army personnel to become directly involved in civilian law enforcement, the Posse Comitatus Act? Are they seeking to identify anti-war demonstrators whom they harassed in the 1960s? Are they getting ready to round up more civilians for detention without trial, as they did to Japanese Americans during World War II? Is counterterrorism becoming the sort of investigative obsession that anti-communism was in the 1950s and 1960s, with all the bureaucratic excesses and abuses that entailed? This isn't the first time that the military has slipped the bounds of law to spy on civilians. In the late 1960s, it secretly gathered personnel information on more than a million law-abiding Americans in a misguided effort to quell anti-war demonstrations, predict riots, and discredit protesters. I know, because in 1970, as a former captain in Army intelligence, I disclosed the existence of that program. While writing two book-length reports on Army spying for Senator Sam Ervin's Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights, Pyle was struck by the harm that could be done to the nation if the government ever gained untraceable access to the financial records and private correspondences of its critics. Army intelligence was nowhere near as bad as the FBI, with its infamous COINTELPRO, but it responded to my criticisms by putting me on Nixon's enemies list, which meant a punitive tax audit. It also tried to monitor my mail and prevent me from testifying before Congress by spreading false stories that I had fathered illegitimate children. I often wondered what the intelligence community could do to people like me if it really became efficient. Today, national security programs are gaining that efficiency, thanks to the proliferation of computer technology. In his book, The Puzzle Palace, author James Bamford wrote about two new locations for National Security Agency, NSA, databases, one in Utah and the other in Texas. Apparently lacking space at Fort Meade, Maryland, NSA headquarters needed new space to house trillions of phone calls, emails, messages, and data trails, web searches, parking receipts, bookstore visits, and other digital pocket litter. Unlike the British government, which to its great credit allowed public debate on the idea of a central data bank, the NSA obtained the full cooperation of much of the American telecom industry in utmost secrecy after September 11. For example, the agency built secret rooms in AT&T's major switching facilities where duplicate copies of all data are diverted, screened for key names and words by computers, and then transmitted on to the agency for analysis. Thus, these new centers in Utah, Texas, and possibly elsewhere will likely become the centralized repositories for the data intercepted by the NSA in America's version of a Big Brother database, wrote Bamford. Bamford was skeptical as to whether the NSA surveillance would even benefit the country in any ways. Based on the NSA's history of often being on the wrong end of a surprise and a tendency to mistakenly get the country into rather than out of wars, it seems to have a rather disastrous cost-benefit ratio. Were it a corporation, it would likely have gone belly up years ago, said Bamford. The September 11 attacks are a case in point. For more than a year and a half, the NSA was eavesdropping on two of the lead hijackers, knowing that they had been sent by bin Laden while they were in the U.S. preparing for the attacks. The terrorists even chose as their command center a motel in Laurel, Maryland, almost within eyesight of the NSA director's office. Yet the agency never once sought an easy-to-obtain FISA warrant to pinpoint their locations or even informed the CIA or FBI of their presence. Although more thoughtful and aware citizens are concerned enough with the potential misuse of the nationwide electronic surveillance systems increasingly coming online, most are blissfully unaware that these systems, whether operated by military or civilian intelligence agencies, are commanded at the highest levels of the federal government, which have been demonstrated in this work to be filled with globalists seeking to control the world and its population. Electronic surveillance. The potential for Big Brother surveillance has been part of American life for decades. As far back as 1975, Senator Frank Church performed a study of the National Security Agency, NSA, and warned Congress that the NSA capability at any time could be turned around on the American people and no American would have any privacy left. Such is the capability to monitor everything. Telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide. It is ironic that Bush bypassed the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, which was passed after President Nixon used the NSA to spy domestically on political enemies. The Patriot Act, which clearly abridges many American rights, was built upon the little-known FISA bill, which cracked the door open to secret government searches. FISA was passed in the contingencies of the Cold War and in the wake of revelations of abuse and surveillance by the FBI and CIA. The FISA law created the Secret Federal Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or FISC, which meets in total secrecy to routinely approve covert surveillances on non-Americans by intelligence agencies. All applications to the court must be approved by the Attorney General. Either federal prosecutors are extremely efficient and effective in their work, or the federal judges, originally numbering 7 but expanded to 11 by the Patriot Act, who make up this secret court, are not picky about the Constitution because out of the some 12,000 requests for secret surveillances and physical searches made during the first 23 years of the FISC, not one application was denied until 4 in 2003. Why the sudden scrutiny of surveillance requests to the FISC? This was due to provisions of the Patriot Act, drafted by the Bush administration and secretly fine-tuned by the House and Senate leadership, that expanded FISA to include Americans. Although FISA legislation was meant to impose limits and a review process upon warrantless surveillance and searches conducted for national security purposes, the current use of the FISA process, now expanded through the Patriot Act and its revisions, has resulted in the erosion of numerous constitutional rights and basic legal procedures traced back to the Magna Carta. Church's warning that the NSA's surveillance ability could be turned on Americans became reality 30 years later when President George W. Bush ordered the NSA to monitor Americans without seeking warrants from the Special Intelligence Court, FISC, or any other court. It was also revealed in 2006 that the NSA had already been secretly collecting phone call records of millions of Americans using data from AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South, the three largest companies in the United States. General Michael Hayden, appointed director of the CIA in 2006, oversaw the program during his tenure heading the NSA. During the Bush years, wiretapping and surveillance became highly politicized after the New York Times disclosed to the public news of a secret electronic monitoring program that had swept up information on American citizens for years without court approval. Controversy grew in early 2006 when it was reported that President Bush had instructed the NSA to electronically monitor Americans for signs of terrorism. It is interesting to note that elements of the Patriot Act existed even before George W. Bush came into office. One feature of the Patriot Act that was approved in 2001 had actually been introduced, yet failed to pass, in 1998. During the Clinton administration, there was a brief furor over proposed new federal banking regulations that would require all banks to report to the government any large deposits, withdrawals, or unusual activity from the banking public. Euphemistically called the Know Your Customer program, it heralded a new era where law-abiding citizens might have to defend their financial matters before government agents. Under the program, banks would be required to create a profile of each customer and report any deviation from the profile to the feds. For example, if a person sold an unneeded car and then deposited the cash into his bank account, the banks would report this to the government. The bank computer would flag the transaction because the money from the car sale was an unusually large deposit based on the person's previous deposit record. Federal authorities would be notified, and soon agents would be sent to interrogate the customer on the chance he or she might be a drug dealer or terrorist. In 1998, Representative Ron Paul planned to introduce legislation to stop this intrusive program, but an irate citizenry saved him the trouble. The schemers behind the proposal, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the IRS, and other agencies, quickly backed off. Paul said quite prophetically, "Somehow, though, I imagine such action will not stop them, only slow them down." Paul was right. Almost all of the provisions of the Know Your Customer program can be found in the Patriot Act. This legislation can undermine the general public's ability to carry out their daily lives. It can red flag your bank account if you deposit or withdraw a certain amount of money, and this amount keeps changing. Once the government was notified if there was more than $10,000 involved. By 2010, this amount had dropped to $5,000. In early 2006, Rhode Island retired schoolteacher Walter Senge and his wife tried to pay down an excessive credit card bill with a JCPenney MasterCard. They sent in a check for $6,500 to pay down their debt. When the Senges found the money had not been credited to their account, they began to make inquiries. They were told that when a payment is much larger than usual, Homeland Security must be notified and that the money is held until a threat assessment is made. The couple's money was eventually freed, although they never found out how making a large credit card payment posed a threat to national security. "If it can happen to me, it can happen to others," Senge said. Even after Congress revised the Patriot Act in 2006, portions of the act still concerned both libertarians and some congressmen. Representative C.L. Butch Otter of Idaho was one of the three Republicans who found the entire act potentially unconstitutional from the onset. One section made it illegal for one citizen to tell another that the authorities were conducting searches of his property or business. Section 215 authorizes the FBI to acquire any business records whatsoever by order of a secret U.S. court. The recipient of such a search order is forbidden from telling any person that he has received such a request. This is a violation of the First Amendment right to free speech and the Fourth Amendment protection of private property, commented Otter. Some of these provisions place more power in the hands of law enforcement than our founding fathers could have dreamt, and severely compromises the civil liberties of law-abiding Americans. This bill, while crafted with good intentions, is rife with constitutional infringements I could not support. The issue of leveling penalties against persons who reveal how the government intrudes on private life was a central point of controversy when Congress renewed the Patriot Act in late 2005. The Patriot Act's Section 215 contains a gag order clause that was retained by Congress only after legislators reached a compromise on the wording. The gag order clause makes permissible the following scenario. If someone's small business is searched by the FBI, that person is gagged from telling anyone that the feds were there. The compromise made gag orders effective only for a year after a secret search was conducted of a person's property. But even then, 1 year seems too long for Americans to wait to learn that their government is spying on them. It is no surprise that this compromise wasn't sufficient for journalists covering the Patriot Act. According to a New York Times editorialist, the compromise also fails to address another problem with Section 215. It lets the government go on fishing expeditions, spying on Americans with no connection to terrorism or foreign powers. The act should require the government, in order to get a subpoena, to show that there is a connection between the information it is seeking and a terrorist or a spy. Given that the United States had been attacked on 9/11 and was fighting in Iraq, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez publicly argued that spying on the American public was within the legal rights of a wartime president. Yet, when members of the Senate Judiciary Committee asked to see why Bush was within legal rights to spy on the public, the White House denied requests for classified legal documents that were behind Gonzalez's defense. Opponents to the NSA's warrantless spying claimed it not only was intrusive and a violation of constitutional safeguards on privacy, but also ineffective because it overloaded law enforcement agencies with bad leads. They also saw the surveillance program as a serious step to consolidating power in the executive branch. The history of power teaches us one thing, said former Reagan administration attorney Bruce Fine. If it's unchecked, it will be abused. Nadine Strossen, a professor of law at New York University and president of the American Civil Liberties Union, was also appalled after reading the provisions of the Patriot Act. According to Strossen, many of the Act's provisions have little or nothing to do with fighting terrorism. There is no connection between the September 11 attacks and what is in this legislation, Strossen argued. Most of the provisions related not just to terrorist crimes, but to criminal activity generally. This happened, too, with the 1996 anti-terrorism legislation, where most of the surveillance laws have been used for drug enforcement, gambling, and prostitution. Strossen was right. By 2005, the Patriot Act provisions were often being used for cases other than terrorism. According to New Jersey Star-Ledger writer Mark Mueller, while the Justice Department says it does not uniformly track the Patriot Act's use in such cases, a reading of government reports and congressional testimony shows it has been used hundreds of times against the likes of drug dealers, computer hackers, child pornographers, armed robbers, and kidnappers. In Washington state, investigators invoked the law to surreptitiously bug a tunnel that had been bored beneath the U.S.-Canadian border by drug runners. In Las Vegas, prosecutors used it to seize the financial records of a strip club owner suspected of bribing local government officials. Investigative reporter Kelly O'Meara noted that a similar anti-terrorist act in England allows government investigators to obtain information from internet service providers about their subscribers without a warrant. The British law is now being applied to minor crimes, tax collection, and public health measures, so it probably won't be long before this insidious bypassing of former rights takes place in America. Obama's opinions on electronic surveillance have been a lightning rod since he shifted positions during the 2008 presidential campaign. Early in his campaign, Obama had opposed granting immunity to telecommunications companies from lawsuits by Americans who believed their privacy had been violated in government electronic data collection programs. Yet in July 2008, then-Senator Obama, over the objections of liberals, voted to support expanding the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which grants immunity to the telecommunications firms. This flip-flopping by Obama prompted Tucker Bounds, a spokesman at the time for the John McCain campaign, to say, He's willing to change positions, break campaign commitments, and undermine his own words in his quest for higher office. It might be noted that McCain, campaigning in Pittsburgh, was absent for the vote. Many liberals on the House Judiciary Committee had wanted the Bush administration's surveillance excesses corrected, yet Deputy Assistant Attorney General Todd Hinnon told the committee that although the Obama administration was willing to negotiate stronger privacy protection for the public, it insisted on keeping in place current authority to track suspects and obtain records. Committee Chairman John Conyers, a Michigan Democrat, groused, "You sound like a lot of people who came over from DOJ, the Department of Justice, before." What Conyers did not clarify was that the people from the DOJ were from the Bush administration. In early 2009, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, a U.S.-based international nonprofit advocacy and legal organization dedicated to defending civil rights in the digital world, challenged government electronic surveillance by suing the NSA over the eavesdropping of millions of ordinary Americans. In April that same year, the Obama administration filed a motion to dismiss the suit. Obama defended his decision by adopting the Bush administration's argument: the courts cannot judge the legality of the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program. Furthermore, a court case would disclose state secrets. President Obama promised the American people a new era of transparency, accountability, and respect for civil liberties, commented EFF senior staff attorney Kevin Bankston. But with the Obama Justice Department continuing the Bush administration's cover-up of the National Security Agency's dragnet surveillance of millions of Americans and insisting that the much-publicized warrantless wiretapping program is still a secret that cannot be reviewed by the courts, it feels like deja vu all over again. When asked what the Founding Fathers might say about the use of the Patriot Act, Congressman Ron Paul laughed and said, "Our forefathers would think it's time for a revolution. This is why they revolted in the first place. They revolted against much more mild oppression." Magic Lantern, Fluent Detective, and N-Case. The globalists have not limited themselves to merely subverting and neutralizing the flow of information on the Internet. Law enforcement possesses a device called a keylogger, which can be secretly installed into computers using a virus-like program. The device, codenamed Magic Lantern, allows authorities to capture passwords by recording every keystroke on the computer. Authorities can then use the passwords to access encrypted data files. The FBI has acknowledged using such a device in a recent gambling investigation. Again, this kind of law enforcement tactic is beneficial to the public good if it is used on criminals. However, William Newman, director of the ACLU in Western Massachusetts, said Magic Lantern technology could easily be used to spy on all Americans. He pointed out that federal law enforcement agencies now are permitted the same access to your internet use and to your email use that they had to your telephone records. Agencies could easily overstep their authority. The history of the FBI is that they will do exactly that. In a 2007 Wired magazine article, former hacker and senior editor Kevin Poulsen wrote about how the FBI used technology similar to Magic Lantern to catch a teenager making bomb threats. According to Poulsen, court papers offered the first public glimpse into the Bureau's long-suspected spyware capability, in which the FBI adopts techniques more common to online criminals. In an affidavit to the U.S. District Court in the Western District of Washington, FBI agent Norman Sanders described the software as a Computer and Internet Protocol Address Verifier, CPAV. Coulson explained that this software was sent to the owner of an anonymous MySpace profile linked to bomb threats against Timberline High School near Seattle. The code led the FBI to 15-year-old Josh Glazebrook, a student at the school who pleaded guilty to making bomb threats, identity theft, and felony harassment. In July 2007, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit Court supported the Washington court's decision that this type of computer monitoring without a wiretap warrant is legally permissible because Internet users have no reasonable expectation of privacy when using the Internet. Law enforcement and intelligence agencies are hard at work developing other types of technology that are purportedly necessary to fight terrorism. For example, the CIA is developing a program called Fluent, which searches foreign websites for terrorist activities and displays an English translation back to Langley. Fluent may be used in conjunction with OASIS, a technology that transcribes into English worldwide radio and TV broadcasts. The FBI and some police departments are now using a software program called Detective to record financial transactions with dramatically improved surveillance video feeds from banks and ATMs. The feds are even working on techniques for restoring videotapes and computer disks that have been destroyed, cut up, or tossed in water. One software program called Encase can recover deleted computer files and search for incriminating documents on any computer. This was used by the FBI to examine computers seized in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. In 2010, testing was being done on a device that emits an electromagnetic pulse capable of disabling the engine of any vehicle. The developers hoped to have a portable model ready in the near future for use by police. They said it would signal the end of dangerous car chases. All this surveillance technology could hypothetically lead to scary scenarios, such as the one envisioned by Village Voice editor Russ Kick. You just got a call that your sister is in critical condition in the hospital, so you jump in your car and hit the gas. Trouble is, the speed limit is 30 miles per hour, and your car won't let you drive any faster. Or maybe you're lucky enough to have a vehicle that still lets you drive at the speed you choose. A cop pulls you over and demands a saliva sample so he can instantly match your DNA to a databank of criminals' genes. You refuse and are arrested. After booking, the authorities force you to submit to brain fingerprinting, a technology that can tell if memories of your illegal events are in your mind. By this point, you're thinking this is a worst-case scenario, a science fiction dysphoria. Well, wake up and smell the police state. Because all this technology, and more, is already being implemented. National ID Act. For years, pundits have consistently brought up the idea of a national identification card, while civil libertarians have consistently cooled the public's receptivity to such a concept, until now. Even as the terror following 9/11 began to subside in 2002, Representative Jim Moran of Virginia cited increased concern over terrorism and introduced legislation in Congress titled the Driver's License Modernization Act of 2002, H.R. 4633. The bill was styled as a law, which would set uniform standards for driver's licenses in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. But what was most disturbing was that it also included provisions to establish a national database and identification system. Moran's bill codified a plan developed by Congress that urged the Department of Transportation to develop electronic smart driver's licenses. The licenses would contain embedded programmable computer chips that could be read by law enforcement authorities across the nation. It's more of a national ID system, a linking of Department of Motor Vehicles and the records they keep on you, across state lines, with some extra on-card security measures thrown in, wrote Frank Pellegrini of Time.com. The plan, Congress hopes, will be cheaper and easier to implement, and less likely to incur the talk show ire of civil libertarians and states' rights purists, the same type who squawked in 1908 when the FBI was born. But the approach is mere stealth. 50 different state ID cards, all linked together, is pretty much the same as one national ID card, just as all those new quarters are still worth 25 cents each, no matter which state is on the back. The House bill also stated the new ID card must conform to any other standards issued by the Secretary of Transportation, an open invitation for bureaucrat tinkering. The Rearing and Empowering America for Longevity Against Acts of International Destruction, or Real ID Act of 2005, was passed in an effort to set standards for all driver's licenses, making them acceptable for official purposes as defined by the Secretary of Homeland Security. These purposes included entering any federal building and boarding any commercial airliner. But the states balked at the plan, not due to privacy and control concerns, but because of the cost of implementing it, and by 2008, an extension was given to all states. As concerns over Real ID grew, by October 2009, at least 25 states had passed resolutions or legislation withdrawing from Real ID. In April 2009, without acknowledging the rebellion of the states over the Real ID Act, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano announced she was working with governors to repeal the Real ID Act. Napolitano, a former governor of Arizona, said she wanted to substitute the federal law with something else that pivots off the driver's license but accomplishes some of the same goals. She added, "And we hope to be able to announce something on that fairly soon." A chip in your shoulder. Lovers of liberty rejoiced when Moran's bill failed to become law and the ensuing Real ID Act bombed in the state houses. However, most states now issue driver's licenses with a magnetic strip capable of carrying computer-coded information. Driver's licenses are not the only ID cards to contain computer-coded information. New York City became one of the first major cities to announce plans to try out microchipped identification cards for the city's 250,000 employees. Some 50,000 officers and workers for the NYPD were scheduled to receive ID cards. The state-of-the-art plastic cards contain microchips, holograms, and other security devices to prevent theft. On the front of this picture ID is the Statue of Liberty and two chips, one containing fingerprints and handprints, and the other filled with personal information, including blood type and emergency telephone numbers. Police officials said that eventually the ID cards will be used in conjunction with biometric hand scanners to ensure the person bearing the card is the correct one. They also hope to save money in computing paychecks by using the cards to keep track of employee hours. Times' Frank Pellegrini has warned that the real fight for privacy will be over when and where citizens will have to show such IDs. "The average American's driver's license gets a pretty good workout these days," he said. "Certainly far more than traffic laws themselves would seem to warrant, but you can only get arrested for driving without one. If the U.S. domestic response starts to resemble Zimbabwe's, which passed a law in November 2001 making it compulsory to carry ID on pain of fine or imprisonment, well, that's something to worry about." In 2002, author Stephen Yates, a teaching fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, warned, "The long and short of it is, the Driver's License Modernization Act of 2002 would bring us closer than ever before to establishing a comprehensive national ID system. The present excuse is that extreme measures are necessary to protect us against terrorism. It is a testimony to how much this country has changed since 9/11 that no one has visibly challenged H.R. 4633 as unconstitutional and incompatible with the principles of a free society. The 1990s gave us the obviously corrupt Clinton regime and a significant opposition to federal power grabs. Now it's Bush the Younger, beloved of neocons, neoconservatives, who see him as one of their own and believe he can do no wrong. Clearly, the slow encirclement of law-abiding U.S. citizens with national ID technology would advance such a cause, globalism or the New World Order, while doing little, if anything, to safeguard us against terrorism." Yates predicted a chilling future where the feds could stifle dissent by freezing a dissident's assets by reprogramming his or her database information. Scanners would not recognize the dissenter and he or she would become officially invisible, unable to drive or work legally, have a bank account, buy anything on credit, or even see a doctor. "Do we want to trust anyone with that kind of power?" he asked. Already, the practice of marking people for identification through computer systems is being played out in private industry. In late October 2002, Applied Digital Solutions Incorporated, a high-tech development company headquartered in Palm Beach, Florida, announced a national promotion named Get Chipped for its new subdermal personal verification microchip. Applied Digital Solutions company literature states that its VeriChip is an implantable 12mm by 2.1mm radio frequency device about the size of the point of a typical ballpoint pen. It contains a unique verification number. Utilizing an external scanner, radio frequency energy passes through the skin, energizing the dormant VeriChip, which then emits a radio frequency signal containing the verification number. The number is displayed by the scanner and transmitted to a secure data storage site by authorized personnel via telephone or internet. The chip can be used to access non-public facilities such as government buildings and installations, nuclear power plants, national research laboratories, correctional institutions, and transportation hubs, either by itself or in conjunction with existing security technologies such as retinal scanners, thumbprint scanners, or face recognition devices. Applied Digital Solutions officials believe the chip will eventually be used in a wide range of consumer products, including PC and laptop computers, personal vehicles, cell phones, and homes and apartments. They said the implanted chip will help stop identity theft and aid in the war against terrorists. In addition to VeriChip centers in Arizona, Texas, and Florida, the firm also fields the Chipmobile, a motorized marketing and chipping vehicle. The firm's Get Chipped campaign was launched just days after the Food and Drug Administration ruled that the chip is not a regulated medical device. Tommy Thompson, a former Wisconsin governor and Secretary of Health and Human Services in the George W. Bush administration, subsequently joined the board of directors of VeriChip. He pledged to get chipped and encouraged Americans to do the same, so their electronic medical records would be available in emergencies. By early 2006, fears of mandatory chipping became reality when a Cincinnati video surveillance firm, CityWatcher.com, began to require employees who worked in its secure data center to implant the VeriChip device into their arm. Many also feared that the microchips were being included in the swine flu vaccine. In September 2009, VeriChip Corp. announced that its stock shares had tripled after the company was granted an exclusive license to patents for implantable virus detection systems in humans. The system used biosensors that can detect swine flu and other viruses and was intended to combine with VeriChip's implantable radio frequency identification devices, or ARFIDs, to develop virus triage detection systems, microchips in one's bloodstream broadcasting the body's information to whoever has a reader device. The use of GPS devices is reminiscent of the 1987 film The Running Man, in which Arnold Schwarzenegger is equipped with a collar that will blow his head off if he leaves a certain area. So if microchipping the population sounds like something from a science fiction movie, consider the giant drug corporation Novartis has already tested a microchip that reminds a person to take his or her medicine by transmitting a signal to a receiver chip implanted in the patient's shoulder. The pill itself contains a tiny, harmless microchip that signals the receiver chip each time a pill is taken. If the patient fails to take a pill within a prescribed time period, the receiver chip signals the patient or a caretaker to remind the person. Novartis's head of pharmaceuticals, Joe Jimenez, said testing of the chip in the pill to a shoulder receiver chip had been carried out on 20 patients by the close of 2009. One shouldn't count on government watchdog organizations to always maintain privacy rights. In late 2002, the American Civil Liberties Union gave its stamp of approval to an electronic tracking system that uses GPS satellites to track suspects and criminals. Created by the Veridin Company of Arlington, Virginia, this Veritrax system not only keeps tabs on convicted criminals, but also on suspects. It can even match a person's position to high crime areas or crime scenes and suggest that the person may be involved in lawbreaking. Law enforcement agencies can create electronic fences around areas they deem off-limits to those wearing a cell phone-sized GPS receiver. The person who wears the module must tie it around his or her waist, while an electronic bracelet worn on the ankle acts as an electronic tether to the GPS receiver that records the person's exact position. Should the wearer move outside the prescribed area, the authorities are signaled and a police unit is dispatched. At night, the wearer must place the module in a docking system to recharge batteries and upload its data to a central headquarters, which checks to see if the wearer has been at any crime scenes. How do you get someone to agree to this monitoring system? Sheriff Don Elslinger of Seminole County, Florida, answered, "It's either wear the GPS device or go to jail." Most of them find this much more advantageous than sitting in a cold jail cell, and it also saves us between $45 and $55 a day. Elslinger said his county had equipped 10 pre-trial suspects with the GPS device as a condition of making bond. According to Elslinger, county officials hoped to expand the program to include nonviolent probationers and parolees. For many, using GPS tracking devices to track criminals makes sense. Yet disturbingly, surveillance technology has not been limited to felons and probationers. In Texas, some 1,000 teenage drivers allowed an unnamed insurance company to place a transponder in their vehicles to keep track of their speed on the road. Texas Representative Larry Phillips introduced a bill in 2005 that would have required all state automobile inspection stickers to carry a built-in electronic transponder. The device would transmit information like the car's vehicle identification number, or VIN, insurance policy number, and license plate number, and should the owner's insurance expire, the person would be mailed a $250 ticket. This bill was not passed. The firm Digital Angel has developed a wristband that allows parents to log onto the internet and instantly locate their children, who must wear the bracelet. Another company, eWorld Track, is working on a child tracking device that will fit inside athletic shoes. The German firm Siemens has tested a 7-ounce tracking device that allows constant communication between parents and their children. Author and political critic Joe Queenan quipped, "Fusing digital mobile phone technology and satellite-based global positioning system and good old-fashioned insanity, the device can pinpoint a child within several yards in a matter of seconds." Support has grown in the American legal system for GPS surveillance technology. In spring 2002, the Nevada Supreme Court ruled it was okay for police to hide electronic monitoring devices on people's vehicles without a warrant for as long as they want. The court ruled that there is no reasonable expectation of privacy on the outside of one's vehicle, and that attaching an electronic device to a man's car bumper did not constitute unreasonable search or seizure. In July 2004, a Louisiana court ruled it was permissible for police there to make warrantless searches of homes and businesses, even without probable cause. In September 2009, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled that the state constitution allows police to break into a suspect's car to secretly install a GPS tracking device, provided that authorities have a warrant before they do so. The unanimous ruling upheld the drug trafficking conviction of Everett H. Connolly, a Cape Cod man who was tracked by state police in 2004 after they installed a GPS device in his minivan. The court declared the GPS device an investigative tool and said it did not violate the ban on unreasonable search and seizure in the state's Declaration of Rights. "We hold that the warrants for GPS monitoring of a vehicle may be issued," Justice Judith Cowan stated in the court's opinion. the Commonwealth must establish before a magistrate that GPS monitoring of the vehicle will produce evidence that a crime has been committed or will be committed in the near future. Generally, search warrants expire after 7 days, yet the court said GPS devices can be installed for up to 15 days before police must prove that the devices need to remain in place. In an attempt to provide protection against the widespread use of GPS devices by law enforcement, William Leahy, chief counsel for the Committee on Public Counsel Service, said the court's ruling means that police must persuade a judge they have probable cause before the GPS devices can be installed.